Hey, I'm Michael Dorinda.
And I'm Jake Bennett.
And welcome to episode number 154 of the North Meets South web podcast.
Indeed, indeed. Here we are, folks, back again, back at it. One day late, but that's okay. That's okay.
Day
sometimes
late,
it's hard to line up the schedules. You know, that's like the tagline for our podcast is conquering a 14 and a half hour time difference to bring you kind of what's going on in our collective lives here in the dev
world. Hemispheres.
Yeah, in our hemispheres. Exactly. So how are things going for you, my friend? How's life?
Life is good. We are currently living through our first school holiday. So I don't know how it works with US schools, but the kids are like 9 to 11-ish weeks per term, and then there's a two-week holiday period. So Eli is in his first school holidays, and so we're kind of balancing what we do with that. So he's got a couple of days a week where he's at vacation care, a couple of days a week where he's...
I was going to say, does daycare, how's that work? Yeah.
He's too old. Yeah, he's too old to go to daycare, but they have like a vacation care program, which is the... like at the same place that the after hours care is at his school. So it's, you know, easy to just walk him down there in the morning and pick him up again as usual in the afternoon, like a normal school day, really.
Nice. Okay.
But I dropped him off for the first time on Monday. And I said, oh, so like I'm back here at 3 or is it 2? And they're like, we're here at 6. I'm like, really? Like, no, I can't leave him there until 6. He was exhausted, the poor thing, after his first day. Because going to school, you know, there's a recess and there's lunch and there's a bit of playtime, but it's structured. Mostly, you know, sitting down and learning and structured learning and stuff. Whereas at vacation care, he was just running around all day and he was chasing older kids and having the best time. And so, you know, when he got home, he's like, we're walking home and he gets like halfway down the street and he goes, you know, it'd be really good if there were couches on the street so we could rest on the way home. I said, are you tired, bud? So he got home and set himself up on his little sofa and he had a rest there. And he came into my office about an hour after he got home. And he goes, Dad, I think I might go and have a rest in my bed. And he took his can of Pringles and he took his iPad and he was just laying in there. And he didn't come out again until like 6:15. He didn't fall asleep, to his credit. But yeah, he was very tired. So I dropped him off there this morning. We'll see how his second day of vacation goes. And then tomorrow I've got the day off and I'll hang out. We're going to go do some stuff tomorrow together. So it'll be good.
That's so funny. It's like, I remember being in college and being like, that was the first time in my life I ever wanted to take a nap, because I remember just being so tired from staying up so late and getting up so early. We actually, I don't know. It's been a weird week, and I think my parents were in town this last weekend. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're all just exhausted. We're all up late and up early and stuff. We had a good time. But like yesterday I came home and I was like, I think I just need to lay down for a couple minutes. And I fell asleep for like 30 minutes. I couldn't believe it. Like that never happens, you know? And I just like woke up like, what time is it? Like, oh, dinner's ready? Okay, I guess we're doing dinner. So anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
I know when I'm tired. Yeah. I know when I'm tired, when I'm on the couch watching TV and then I wake up because Ree's telling me it's time for bed.
Yeah, right.
Okay. No worries.
Nice. That's hilarious. Yeah. So anyway, it's been a weird couple of days for us too, as far as tiredness and all that good stuff. But related to him taking his Pringles and his iPad, I remember when I was a kid and thinking, I will know I've made it in life when I can. I remember I wanted to save up and I wanted to get a bag of potato chips and a 2-liter of soda and watch TV. That's, I was like, if I can do that, that is the life. That was like one of my goals. Like if I could do that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And, so anyway, I've made it. I can afford those things and watch TV now. So it's good. Good times.
Yeah. You're just not allowed to. That's generally frowned upon. If I sit down while the kids are running around, it's not good for my health.
No, not happening. No, Harrison today was, he wanted, as soon as, like, literally I walked in the door and he's like, hey, do you want to go play pickleball in the driveway? I'm like, not really. Okay. Do you want to wrestle?
I'll take pickleball.
Hey, do you want to play tag? It's like, dude, I am literally, I just need 5 minutes. I am so, it's been a day. So anyway, kids don't, they don't get it. I said, Harrison, I've had a really long day. And he said, so have I, I'm ready to play. I'm like, oh, okay. That's how you handle your long day. Like you want to, you know, you've been at school all day. You want
to
play with dad.
Ready to play. That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's getting to that time of year where it's getting cold at night.
Yes.
And Eli's like, can we go out and play outside after dinner? And I'm like, nah, it's too dark. It's too cold. Mm-hmm. You don't want to go out there. Mm-hmm. And mom's like, but I said he can go out after dinner. I'm like,
okay, I guess it's time. We're going outside.
That's funny, outside,
dude. That's awesome.
He got this bouncy ball yesterday. We went out for lunch and he got a bouncy ball. So we went out there just pegging that at each other. Oh, pegging means a different thing. for you guys.
It could mean a different thing.
Pegging means to like throw something.
Oh yeah. In the context of throwing something around with your kid, it makes sense. Totally get you. Yeah.
Not in the Deadpool sense.
Oh, I got you. I got you. That's funny. Hey folks out there, if you don't know what a zip chip is and you're interested in throwing something around either outside or in your house that's not going to damage things, you should definitely check it out. Zip chip. It is pretty cool. I've got one and I've had a couple of them because I lost some, but they're pretty fun. It's like a little mini frisbee, but you throw a sidearm like a baseball, and you can get those things to go like the length of a football field. They are awesome. And so they're super fun, super small. You can just take them with you anywhere you go. And they're really enjoyable to throw around. Both of my sons have gotten pretty good at it.
200 plus feet fits in really, pocket.
Yes, it's pretty awesome. And it's like neoprene plastic. It's soft. So like you could chuck it in the house and it can hit a window and it's not going to do anything. It's really... really cool. So me and my son throw that around in the house all the time.
Right. I just bought one. So, Eli's been asking for a frisbee. I don't know where or why this has popped into his head, but this seems fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a good one.
Done that. That'll be okay, here
should
in time
we get,
for his birthday.
Should we get into the adventures of what we've got going on in our individual
adventure away
development world? Okay. So
yeah,
I can tell you about my most recent frustration that I had yesterday. Which was I'm upgrading to Laravel 11 across a bunch of our different applications. And I've got to tell you, if you happen to be doing so, please reach out if you end up with something that you can't figure out, because I've probably already had the problem. Also, I heard Aaron Francis and Ian Landsman saying that people are upgrading too fast. Like, you guys just hold on a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, honestly, I get that. I could get that. It's really annoying to have to be the first person to ask a package maintainer to upgrade to Laravel 11. You know what I mean? You have to be the one to kind of do that.
Never
now, Jason
ask.
McCreary does
you
a good job.
You can't ask someone else to do it, though. You have to be the one that
sends
the pull request.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, you send the pull request, but it's like, hey, can you tag this release? You know, the pull request is here. Here's the tests are passing. Mm-hmm. Can you tag a release on this? Whatever. So we can stay on a stable version instead of dev or whatever. And I don't really want to fork it anyway. So anyway, that side of things. But we're upgrading to Laravel 11. The thing that I was having a hard time with yesterday is trying to figure out how to remove global middleware. So is there a way to stop or to say on a particular set of routes, I don't want the global middleware to apply? And there is not. There's not a way to do that. You cannot do that. I thought there was at one point. I thought there was a way to do it. Either like when you're setting up the routes, like set a route group and do it without middleware, or like in the controller or something. No. Does not work. You cannot do it. So far as I'm quite sure you can't. I tried a bunch of different ways.
It's like an oversight.
It seems like it. It seems like it. But and maybe not. I'm missing something, but I feel like I tried it like four or five different ways. So what you can do is in Laravel 11, you can say, and so for those of you who haven't done it, a lot of the service providers are still available. You know, you can still keep them around. But if you don't want to have the service provider, like your route service provider and your http/kernel.php stuff, a lot of that is just configured in your bootstrap/app.php file. Mm-hmm. And it has a set of fluent methods, and one of them is with middleware. It's like with routing, with middleware. And in the with middleware, what you can do is you can basically take over the global middleware stack and say disregard anything that's set up by default, and you just say middleware arrow use. And that will allow you to set your own set of global middlewares, which is great. The only problem with that is that if Laravel ever adds a new global middleware, it will not get added to your application by default when you upgrade the application, because you won't, it's you're overriding all of that, right? So
right.
I didn't want to do that. That was not preferable. The other thing is that it used to be when there was a shift or something like that, that route service provider, or it's, I can't remember if it was in the route service provider or is in the kernel, all those global middlewares were listed out in a config. So if there was a new one added, you would see it, right?
You'd see it, sure.
But you won't see it anymore because that's all in the framework level now. So those things will not get shifted. It's just in the framework. So the place where you have to go to see that, by the way, is in that with middleware. It injects as the first parameter there, the only parameter, a middleware value. If you click into that, the global middleware, the web middleware, and the API middleware are all listed out in that big class. That's where you can go find them, what's loading in by default. So instead of you know, doing that use statement, what I needed to do is I needed to stop trimming strings and stop converting empty strings to null. That's what I needed to stop doing on my webhooks routes. And the reason why is because those webhooks, when they come in, a lot of times you'll have this validate payload step, right? Where you are checking, Twilio gives you a signature and basically says, use this signature to see if this has been modified since we sent it, right? And so if you MD5 the payload and then you use that signature and you compare them, they should be the same. That's the way you know that they've not been modified since it was sent from Twilio. Well, if you modify it, if you take an empty string and you trim it, you know, and you set it to null, or you trim a string, it's not going to be the same payload.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. And so the validation fails, that hash fails. Yeah. So you can't trim it. You can't empty string to null. You can't do that. So you have to stop doing it on those particular things. Now, the nice thing is that middleware has a bunch of convenience methods on it where you can say like arrow, trim strings, and then you can configure it by saying accept. And then you can pass in a closure that accepts a request and say, if the request is a webhook slash star, don't do it, right? And then you can do the same thing with convert empty to null. You can do the same exact thing, except this. And so that's what I ended up doing. But man alive, took me forever to figure that out. It took me forever to figure that out. And the last thing, the other thing that why I was really frustrating too, is because if you do PHP artisan route list, and then you do accept vendors, that will list out all of your routes for you. It tells you the route, like location, like slash, you know, home, whatever. And then it gives you the name if you've specified one and the controller will go to. But if you do dash V, it'll also include below it, here's the middlewares that you've applied
right.
to it.
Yeah, so that's both the thing I always miss.
Yep. Both the middlewares that you have applied yourself, like specifically, as well as any middleware groups that are applied to it, like web or API. Mm-hmm. If you do dash VV, so very verbose, it will list out not only the ones that you've applied, but it will actually explode that web middleware group and include, it'll show you all the ones that are included on there. However, if you do like dash VVV, you'd think, oh, maybe it includes the global middleware. It does not. It will not ever show you the global middlewares that are being applied there. Mm-hmm. And so if you're trying to like compare, here's my production one and I want to see what's in there, and here's my other one, I want to see what's in there. It's just, it was a little bit tricky to see like, okay, it's apparently never including the global middleware. So if I want to compare those, I just have to kind of go look at the code rather than relying on this command and then comparing the two. Yeah. So, hard fought lessons on that one. but if I would have looked in the docs, it was right there. It said, this stuff does not, without middleware, does not apply to the global middlewares. So stop doing that. So anyway, read the docs, folks. Read the docs.
Yeah, always read the docs.
Yep. And I think Aaron Francis said that too. He's like, right, like just read through all the docs. I recently did that with LiveWire and it was very enlightening. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. This is interesting. A couple things here that I did not realize.
Just reading the documentation gets you a long way. And even for like Taylor, you know, he said in the past that at each major release, he'll go through the entire documentation start to finish and just make sure that it all makes sense, that it's correct for the, you know, the upcoming release and everything is documented that should be documented. So it's a good way to, I mean, it's really, if you like reading, the best way to read the framework. So definitely check it out.
I do have one other thing, but before I go, I will let you go. So what do you got, my friend?
We are getting into the pointy end of some sharp timelines. There's just a lot of work that's like being built, like a lot of stuff's been built in isolation, like front end components have been built separately to back end endpoints, and so we're starting to kind of integrate those two for better or worse as discrete pieces of work to then produce, you know, shippable features. And so it's been an interesting journey over the last 5 or so months of building this way, and kind of now we're getting to the end where all of the functionality kind of exists in the back end, but we're kind of figuring out the best way to join it all together. What endpoints do we create? Where should things be in the context of how the front end, which is a React app, be referencing these things? So sometimes where we would have this resourceful route, we might find it's not in the same context as what the front end is working, or it's expecting there to be some pieces of information available that aren't. And so it's kind of like very minor stuff, but it's just, you know, making the changes in order to make sure that everything is kind of aligned between the two. Certainly not, I wouldn't recommend the approach of like building backend and frontend so discreetly, but just with the volume of work, it's been difficult to kind of pair people up to do like backend and frontend. And I have never used React, and like this is the kind of stuff where it's probably not the best time to learn. I think at some point I'm going to have to at least pick it up because so much of the application is built in it. But I dipped into some of it yesterday just because we were changing the structure of some endpoints on the back end. Instead of sending an array of people and an array of businesses, we kind of merged that into one thing that was an array of parties. And then the party would then be, you know, either a business or a person, and we'll be able to identify that based on a field on that thing. So it was like kind and name I think ID, right? So then the kind would be either business or person, and then you'd have ID and name based on whatever that is, because that was the information the front end had. So rather than having the front end have to figure out, you know, all of this other stuff to pull in, we just like, just send us what you already have and we'll handle the mapping. So going into like these TypeScript places and like changing things and all of this stuff, it just looked like a very foreign land. Even like I said, I've never used React, but even having used Vue in the past, like they are very different things in terms of how they're constructed. And like TypeScript wasn't really as popular the last time that I looked at any of this stuff. So it's something that I'm going to have to, at some stage, pick up and learn. It's just a matter of like, when do we find the time
to do that?
So it'll be an interesting process. But just all of that stuff coming to a head. I stumbled upon yesterday, if you've ever done like nested validation. So if you have an array of things and you want to validate the inside.
Like inside the array. Yeah.
Yeah. So in this context of parties, we would have an array, which was sometimes in the payload or sometimes not. So we've got nullable.
Yeah, sure.
It could be sent, but with nothing in it.
Sure.
And then we say it's an array. But then for each of the things inside, we do like parties dot asterisk.
Yes.
All right, open that. And then you can do whatever you need to do for the individual items. And you can even target specific fields for each of those items. So you can do like parties.star.id and say this has to be numeric. But this other thing that we were looking at was it was just an array of IDs where we would send like a list of other related records that we would have to aggregate up to like this top level item. And I discovered in the documentation there's this like rule for each which accepts a closure and takes like the name of the field being modified and the name and the value, of course. And so you can do this kind of thing where for each of those, you can build up a dynamic set of rules. So we would say like, rather than saying it's specifically one or the other, if we had to refer back to another field in the payload, you could do that using this rules for each, which was kind of nice. So
are you saying you can require if it's particular, like if it's this thing, it's, you know, require when or require if, that sort of deal? Is that what you're talking about? Like if you had to reference a previous value in the payload?
So we're not referencing a previous value. We're referencing another value in the same iteration of that nested array.
Okay.
Right. So we would, in the parties, we would say rule :: for each. And then what we would have to do is we would have to look at the name of the current thing, which would be like parties.0.id, because this is the field that we're validating. For that ID, it could be either a person or a business. But to determine whether it is a person or a business, we need to look at the parties.0.id Kind. So we kind of use string before last period to get like the group that we're in. So parties.0.
Yeah.
And then we can then go and get like parties.0.kind because we know that that is the field. And then we do like a match in there. So we then have a return inside this for each closure that says return match true. And then, you know, if kind is value arrow, you know, fat arrow return rule :: exists business. And if it's person, then we do, you know, rule :: person. We wrap that in parentheses and then we scope that. So it's like, make sure that this thing exists and it's also attached to this arrow application arrow ID. So you get some pretty powerful validation.
Make sure it exists, and then also make sure that it belongs to the tenant that's sort of trying to do it. Is that what it is? The idea? Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So
that's
pretty
intelligent, honestly. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so this basically then makes sure that not only is this like a record that exists in the database, but that it is a record that is related to this lending application or this discovery that we're going through. So it just makes it really easy to scope it. It did wreak havoc on our automatic documentation generation because there's not really a way to inspect the contents of the closure the way that we're doing it. So James Brooks gave a talk on using Scribe for documentation. For whatever reason, it didn't suit our purposes for the way that we were kind of building things. But I think even digging through the source code over there to figure out how do we go about implementing this nested rules stuff, it just didn't seem to handle it at all. Because I think a lot of that stuff kind of happens in the execution flow and it gets passed in the context of the current iteration. So it's hard to kind of infer that from the outside in. But rule for each is very nice if you need to do some more dynamic things with your nested validation rules. So check that one out. I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, that is interesting. I've never actually used that rule before, but I can imagine if you're trying to upload two different types, it would make sense that you'd have to, you know, like for example, that it exists is exactly, you'd have to switch that based on which kind is coming in. So makes sense.
That's really on the back end, like, so this is at the validation, you know, at the front side of it. On the back end, we will take the parties and we'll split them. And so we still have a businesses and a people relationship on that model. It's just for the context of the front end where it just has a collection of parties, we make it easier for that process. Like, it makes sense that they would send and receive this combined collection, but on the back end, obviously we want to store that in a discrete way so we can make, you know, whatever other functionality we need to work on, you know, either people or on businesses that are associated there. So it was Laravel, really. We are very spoiled what,
dude,
it gives us.
Spoiled.
And we've been going down this path of like breaking things up. So our controllers are often just a couple of lines long, our controller methods. Either like if we're doing resources, then, you know, there's four or five methods in there and they're split up into two or three lines only. But we've got form requests, which handle all of our validation and authorization stuff nicely. Mm-hmm. And then we're using, you know, the action paradigm to kind of then defer the behavior, you know, take the request, put it into this action. The action will then do something. It will return a model. And then we wrap that in a Laravel data object, like a sparsely Laravel data object, and return that to the front end.
Nice.
And so that kind of gives us the separation of all of those pieces, but it allows us to very discreetly test them all.
Absolutely.
So if we want to test the
behavior
of like,
you don't have to invoke the controller for all the actions.
Don't have to invoke the controller. Don't have to hit the route. You can test all the boundaries and the edge cases and things like that in the context of the action, because you go into the action and say, hey, what happens if I send this, you know, what conditional checking is happening inside of that method, and test all the code paths there. So the controller tests really only have to test your happy path. You know, I sent a thing and then you got the 200 back or the 201 created, or, you know, you're testing some specific validation scenario. Like, those things are very, very light on. But then testing the action is where you get into the nitty gritty of the business details, which I think has been a pretty big productivity boost. You know, there's more files and there's more clicking around to get to things, but I think it does provide for a more robust application, especially when we have so much business logic to model and things like
exactly.
that. Where we're doing all yeah. of that in a controller, just it gets unwieldy very quickly.
It becomes
and
it very allows difficult us to
split
test.
All these things out. Like you don't have to look at these huge methods and you don't have to have these giant tests that are testing all these things. You can then separate, you know, you've got a store, whatever app action, a update, whatever action, a delete, whatever action. You can test all of those things individually. And then you can have separate test files, test classes, test cases, whatever you're using to test each of those actions discreetly. And so it just spreads things out a little bit more and makes them a little bit more manageable in terms of like, I know that I'm only looking at this discrete piece of work here. So.
Yeah. And the nice thing about that too, is like with those actions, they're transportable, right? Like if you need to do that from the command line or you need to go do, yeah. you know, you need to go do some creation of something somewhere else or deletion or, somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
Yep. You can move yep. them around without having to do all the,
you know,
like,
if you want to put something into a job, if you want to dispatch something over right. here, like if you're taking in a third party request that does something slightly differently or the data comes yep. in a different format, you know, where you don't have control over that, you can do the manipulation. You can create some DTOs to say, okay, this is the thing, get it into a common format. And then you can just say like dispatch this job over here that takes that information and then just shoves it into that action as well. So
they become
much more versatile.
Yeah, because it's standardized, like once you kind of set that precedent, it's everybody knows where to look. So you said like you're clicking yeah. around, and I remember one guy that I worked with, he you know, like for him, less files was better. Always. Like always less files was better. And so he would just cram some of this stuff in there. But It's not always bad. I mean, the IDEs make it yeah. so easy now to command yeah. click through. It's just like it takes it and it contextualizes it to the thing you're concerned about when you're looking at the file. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I want to know about validation. Go click over here. I want to know about how it's been created. Go click over here. I want to know about how I'm generating a response. Go click over here. Like, it's no big deal. It just sort of containerizes it and puts it in its nice little, it's everything yeah. has a place and yeah. you just go click through to go find it. It's not hard anymore.
I would certainly start. Maybe,
it's not hard anymore.
Yeah, sure. I would certainly start sure. simple. Start with less files. You know, do a request validate inside of your controller method and all of that stuff and extract it out when it starts to get unwieldy, when it gets big, when it's hard to look at, when it's hard to test, you know, all that kind of stuff. But once you cross the threshold, and there are some things now that are very, very simple and it doesn't make sense. Like we might forego the action if it's just like a one line, you know, we're updating a single thing or it's a delete, like we'll just maybe just do that in the controller method. It's not a hard and fast thing, but it certainly tidies things up overall.
Absolutely.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
The other thing, just talking about, you know, getting the integration aspect between backend and frontend, we're talking about like moving endpoints and things like that instead of calling it, you know, instead of it being a resourceful route where it's, you know, A/B/C with some IDs in there, we're just like, nah, it's going to be this other thing. And all we do is just change the path in the route file to what it needs to be that contextually makes sense for the front end and things like that. So we've got this thing where we're doing financial scorecards for a business, and it is, you know, in the application context. So we've got like the URL is /application/financial analysis, and then we've got like this has one relation tagged on the end. So we don't need to have an ID because we know that this is linked implicitly and that there is only ever going to be one record. So if you post there, we can pull that from like the root model and just go and update that thing. Just patch it. And it just simplifies things a little bit as well. So yeah, it's been an interesting journey.
Go ahead. Sorry.
It's been an interesting journey just in terms of, you know, having to think about things in the context of how everything is kind of placed in the UI. And because it's all componentized, like these components are hitting their own discrete little endpoints in the same way that I guess if you were doing it in Livewire, you would have a component that would hit a discrete endpoint, right, which is kind of hidden away by the fact that everything goes through Livewire's controller infrastructure. But it's the same kind of thing. Like each component has its own endpoint. And so getting myself into that mindset has been interesting when everything is, you know, we've always typically strived to have RESTful endpoints and RESTful controllers and things like that. So it's, yeah, it's good.
I was going to say, are you guys using something like Ziggy to kind of push your routes in Laravel to the front end? And so for those of you who maybe don't know what Ziggy is, you always have this challenge of if in Laravel you end up using named routes, which I would say are incredibly helpful. It's basically the difference between having a magic string and having some sort of enum, almost. Not really. It's still the magic string, but it's less of a magic string. If you're just having to put in, you know, slash this, slash that, slash ID, whatever, it feels fragile to me. Because if you ever update that endpoint, you got to go in and update the endpoint. You got to actually go update the thing. Whereas if you're using a named route, you just update the URL structure and the named route just continues to reflect that endpoint at the correct location. And so Ziggy, what it does is it takes your routes from Laravel and then it will essentially publish them on the front end. And so they can be consumed by your JavaScript front end. So, you know, you can basically import this route function helper, and then you can do routing on the front end, similar to how you do in Laravel, where you just have a named route. So I was just curious if you guys are using something like that, especially with these URL sort of rewrites or you know, refactors that you guys are doing. Mm-hmm. If you weren't using something like that, I can imagine that'd be quite a painful process.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there is definitely the presence of Ziggy in the front end, but everything is also componentized. So it's like you go to this one place which encapsulates all of that logic. So it's
sure.
Yeah. It's
not quite.
I know that Ziggy's in there. I know that it gets run a couple of times as part of the build process. I don't know what is necessarily using it. I have stayed away from that.
Yeah.
That,
you know, that it's React in there.
Source folder. That, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
Wait.
Well, that's cool, dude. Yeah, that sounds interesting. We do not have a separated, you know, anymore. In a couple of places we do.
Yeah.
But for the most part,
I don't recommend this approach, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just you kind of take the hand you're dealt. You know what I mean? You deal with it and you do the best you can. It sounds like you guys have got a good plan there. And like you said, because you guys have a front end team separate from your back end team, it seems like you're dabbling a little bit in the front end. But since you have two separate teams, it's kind of like what you got to deal with. And so whatever. I mean, it's, you know, there's pros and cons. Everything's a trade-off. So double-edged sword, if you will.
Yeah. I think longer term, there'll be a little bit more, like I'll pick up some more front end. The front end guys, they dabble in the back end and they get help when they need to. That some things, they're just like, it's quicker for them to pick it up. Some things that I can do in the front end, but I'm like, look, it's probably going to be quicker for me to handball this to you and for you to just do it than it is for me to figure out how to do it. And then you have to come and fix it later. So
yeah,
I think longer term, that'll be the go, or it'll be pairing like a front-end person with a back-end person to get a bit more done as well. And then you get some cross-skilling as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. So I was going to loop back real quick. So, you know, you had said how, you know, Laravel basically makes us so productive and we're so spoiled, you know, with Laravel. And so just hired a brand new, not even out of college yet, junior developer. Monday was his first day. And so I'm talking like we're learning Git. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's so crazy how I don't want to like hate on the program that he was in. Super smart guy, really picks things up quickly. But like they didn't even teach him Git. You know what I mean? Like GitHub. Yeah, he never used GitHub. I'm like, what? That is wild. Like, how are we not using GitHub? And then I was like, hey, did they teach you jQuery? He was like, yeah. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, what is happening? They are so woefully behind. Whatever. Any case. I was like, so have you interacted with databases much? Like, you know, had to, you know, create stuff in the database. He's like, yeah, I have. I was like, so let me show you kind of how Laravel does this. So you have a model, user, :, create, pass it in, you're done. He's like, what do you mean you're done? I'm like, that's it. Like, it creates it in the database for you. He's like, his eyes sort of lit. He's like, are you telling me that like all of the applications that you guys have developed, that's how you interact with the database? Like all of them? I'm like, all of them. He's like, that's wild. Like, I can't believe that that's all you have to do. He's like, I thought I was going to have to like write in raw SQL queries and like all this insanity. Nope. It's not just anymore. User :, create, user :, update. I mean, we are so, it's actually really cool to be going back through this with somebody who doesn't know and see like the light in their eyes, and they're like, oh my word, you got to be kidding me. It's that easy. It's literally that easy. Oh, so good.
Uni college is definitely the hardest part of breaking into this industry, I think.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. I mean, it's frustrating, honestly. I got to say it's frustrating because it's, I don't know, like, I don't know how you solve that problem. Like, do the professors need to go back to, like, they're not doing anything real. That's the problem.
Yeah.
They're not staying up to date because they don't have to. There's no pressure on them to go build anything in the real world. So they're just taking the curriculum that they're dealt and they just teach it, mm-hmm. you know? And if they even know it, I don't know, man. It's
interesting. It's also, I've noticed because there's a lot of JavaScript people that I guess are fatigued or had enough or, you know, they're just coming back to PHP just to have a look what they've been missing out on over the last 10 years. It's funny to see all of that kind of conversation happening on Twitter and all mm-hmm. of the people that are like, oh, I can do all of this stuff in Laravel in a fraction of the time.
Yes, right? You know, like in JavaScript, Primogen, whatever, right?
Yeah. In like JavaScript, you are always going, okay, what auth library am I going to use for this project? And then you've got to wire up all of the UI and then all of the backend and all of this kind of stuff. And we, like Laravel, Symfony just has all of this stuff. PHP has all of this stuff available. You don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. You know, Laravel's got the starter kits. You install Breeze or you install Jetstream or what have you, and you've already got registration, authentication. You've got API basic keys, profile stuff,
teams,
API keys, teams. All of that stuff is just there. It's not critical to your application. It's not unique to your application. Authentication is a solved problem, and that there are people out there building these things over and over each time. And the fact that no one in the JavaScript ecosystem has really kind of taken a foothold on that to like go, no. Yeah, I know that there is a project and the name of it escapes me, but there is a project that tried to be like the Laravel for
I remember. Yeah, I don't remember what it was called, but I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like it just never took off. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Very spoiled. Very thankful for Taylor and
absolutely. Yep. And so I told him that. I said like developer experience is such a high priority for Laravel, I said, which is why it's taken off and just exploded with the number of people using it. And I said, PHP is so ubiquitous; you can host it anywhere. Yeah. I mean, like, it's just, you know, we're so I'm so thankful to live in the time in which we do. So, anyway, the other thing that's kind of crazy too is that I also a year and a half ago had hired a guy who never went to college, was 19, was completely self-taught, had read Matt Stauffer's Laravel Up and Running book. And was like, had just learned stuff on his own. And it was like, he knew is everything he needed to know. And, you know, had the potential to earn as every bit as much as somebody who went to 4 years of college. It's just a bit crazy.
It's crazy. You read the docs, read, you know, Laravel up and running.
Read the docs.
If you're going to get a book,
bootcamp.laravel.com,
if you're in a position to buy it, do that. Read the docs, do the bootcamp. If you want something a little bit extra, get the Laravel up and running book. Get your Laracast subscription and you will be in
onramp.dev. You know what I mean? Onramp.dev is such a great resource too for like, you know, Matt Stauffer.
If you are willing to spend the time to read the materials, then it is, and it's like, it's easier than ever to install Herd on your computer. PHP is available.
Yes.
Web
is
available.
Yes.
Just, you know, get it done. And it's very, very simple. Like, don't get me wrong, it's very hard to be good at software development over a long period of time,
mm-hmm.
but it is easier than ever to get started and be productive. So,
yeah. Well, we are at, how much time we got? I wanted to talk about two more little things here if we got time. How much time we have?
We're at 38.
38, oh boy. Okay, here's I'll make it one thing then, okay? In Laravel 11, when you're doing a shift as well, like one of the things that you're trying to do is you're trying to get rid of as many configs as you can. I am anyway. Mm-hmm. So shift will kind of take out everything that it can. If there's anything that's different, it'll leave it in there. One of the things that it does is that in Laravel 11, it will update the timestamps of a migration when a package publishes a migration. So you've probably seen this before where you install a package and the package is an old package, but it's been updated. And you publish a migration and the migration is from like 2019, right?
Right.
And so like it in the timestamp, this is like 2019, mm-hmm. whatever. Yeah, it's super stupid. And so instead of that, Laravel will now update the timestamp of that by default, which is great. If you don't want that to happen, you have to, in the database.php, specify false. Do not update the timestamp. The only reason why you might want to do that is in the case that you're having to republish migrations. If you are if you are updating with a new timestamp, it might think that there's a new migration that needs to run. You're going to have this database already exists. That's a problem sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why you need to allow it. And sometimes you can keep database.php around. However, if you squash your migrations, this is not a problem. It will mm-hmm. it will just take care of this. You don't have to worry about that. Not a big deal. So squash migrations, take that part out. You can get rid of database.php altogether most of the time.
Nice.
However, the warning that I have here is this. If you have ever thought to yourself, I'm going to create a migration, and this migration is going to not only set up the structure, but it's also going to just include any of the data that I would need for my application to work. I'm not going to seed the thing. Mm-hmm. I just, when I create this states table, I'm just going to go ahead and include the states, because why wouldn't I, right? Mm-hmm. When you do a dump, a schema dump, it does not look through your migrations. It doesn't care about your migrations. What it does is it looks at your current database, dumps the structure of that database, and ignores the content. Doesn't care about the content. And then if you do dash dash prune, which we did, because why would you keep those values around?
Yeah.
It will then take all the data that was in there, right? And it's just completely gone. It's not in there anymore. So as a result, our tests started failing. Like, this data is no longer there that we were relying upon. So you have to be aware that when you're doing that MySQL schema dump stuff, it's not including that data that was originally there. Yeah. So you have to decide kind of how you want to handle that. You either have to create a new migration that's on top of the schema dump that basically reintroduces that data, or you can even modify that MySQL schema dump, and you could do the injection in there as well. You could just insert those values in that schema dump, which is fine. That's what we decided to do. Or you could not prune, right? I suppose that would maybe work as well. So anyway, that was just something that's caught us out a couple times since we've been squashing these migrations. I will say the tests have gotten faster for sure, because it doesn't have to run through 100 migrations every single test, which is really nice. But just be aware, if you've sort of used that pattern before, which we have a couple different places, watch out, because it could bite you when you squash those migrations and prune them all out.
Yeah, I do like putting, like, the application can't run without this data. So I like putting that stuff in the migration.
Yeah, exactly.
In a world where you are doing schema dumps like that, which and then pruning where you don't have it, I think it makes sense for the migration to call the seeder. So to take all that stuff and put it into a seeder so that the migration can then call the seeder to do that, but it means that you've also got the seeder around if you ever find yourself in a situation where you need to drop a table or empty a table.
That's an interesting way to do that.
Or anything like that. So
I see. So
that is one such approach.
So the only problem with that is, like, when you run so the only problem is that if you have the MySQL schema dump thing, you can't call a seeder from that.
No. You can't do it in the dump, but you would still have the seeder around. If you've pruned the migration files, you've got to go digging through Git history.
I see what you're saying. You're saying in the case that you run a migration, so like what I would, ideally what I would have done, you're saying, is yes, put it in the migration, but make that portion a seeder so that it's actually seeding the database with that with those values.
And it just calls that makes seed sense. Or artisan.
Sure.
You know, artisan called DB seed or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For us, it's like, so we originally were toyed around with, like, well, we'll just seed it. It's like, but the tests, you don't want to have to seed the database when you're doing a test, You just want it to work. So it's like, how do you do that? So that's why we decided that MySQL dump, we're just going to write the insert statements. And also, just as kind of a FYI for how this works, at the bottom of that SQL dump file, it will then insert all the migrations that it collapsed. So at the bottom, it says insert, and then the names of all the migrations that it pruned off.
It puts in the migrations file.
Yeah. It puts in the migrations folder table. So that... You got it exactly right. So that when it goes to look at the table to see if the migrations have run, they're all there. And so it won't run any migrations that have already been run. It'll only run new ones since it was dumped. FYI on that. Yep. All right, folks. I think we'll call it there. Michael, what episode are we on? 156?
154.
154. Folks, thanks for hanging out with us. Find show notes for this episode at northmeetssouth.audio/154. Hit us up on Twitter at Jacob Bennett and Michael Dwinder, or at North South Audio. And if you would rate our podcast up in your podcatcher of choice, 5 stars would be super appreciated. Thanks, folks. Until next time. See ya.
Into it.